Hello, this is Charles Calhoun from the Maine Humanities Council, and I'd like to welcome you to another in our series of podcasts exploring the power and pleasure of ideas in Maine. I take particular pleasure this evening in introducing the first of them, Caroline Alexander. You can read a very short, condensed version of her biography in the packet, along with the biographies of the other speakers. So I won't rehearse all those again, but I do want to say three things about her, three aspects of her career that I'd like to call to your particular attention by way of introducing her. First is, as you can see from this short version of her resume, she has impeccable scholarly credentials as a classicist. Yet she has chosen to spend most of her remarkable career as a writer, as a filmmaker, as a traveler, outside of the academy. She's taken on and mastered that essential, though it seems to me underappreciated and certainly underpaid task, of mediating between the world of scholarship, the world of professional classicist and archaeologist, and the world of the serious general readers, which is all of us. And for evidence of that mastery, you don't have to look any farther than her recent book, On the Death of Achilles. We have copies in its paperback edition. You may have seen already, you may have bought one already. The USM bookstore has very kindly set up a table for us. And Caroline has very graciously agreed to sign copies at the end of before you go to dinner or the reception, or also tomorrow morning when the bookseller will be back if you haven't bought a copy already. So please don't miss out on taking a look at those books. It's probably the best and certainly the most readable introduction to the Iliad, certainly that I've ever come across. Secondly, rather than rest on those laurels, she's taken on an even more daunting task, translating the entire epic. This will be published by Echo Press, a branch of HarperCollins. You can sample a fragment of her work in the Achilles book. The section on the death of Hector is her original translation, and it gives us a hint of the glories to come. In the not-too-distant past, Caroline was also a world-class pentathlete. Is that the right word? World-class nonetheless, and a pentathlete. And I trust the same qualities of endurance, ability to focus on a task, and versatility will carry her through the arduous, but I hope at times exhilarating job of translating Homer. I feel a little guilty dragging you away from your workbench, as it were, to bring you here, but I'm very grateful that you agreed to join us tonight, and we really appreciate it. And finally, after some years in the wilds of New Hampshire, she has seen the light and has moved or is in the process of moving to coastal Maine. We hope that she and Frank will soon be a part of the Maine humanities community and will be so for a long time to come. In settling in Northeast Harbor, she's following in the footsteps of another major writer, translator, and champion of the classics, Marguerite Yourcenar. Madame Yourcenar found a refuge on Mount Desert Island in the long years before she became so famous in the 1980s, and it was there that she wrote her masterpiece, The Memoirs of Hadrian. So I hope the shade of Marguerite Yourcenar is peering beneficently over your shoulder as you set about your own task. So please join me, ladies and gentlemen, in welcoming Caroline Alexander.
I'm very happy to be here mediating between the walls, as he says, of the ivory towers of academia and the real world. I find it thrilling to see the so-called academic subjects being engaged with robustly and under compulsion. Nobody here is sort of having to take Humanities 101 to get their degree and, you know, coming in scowling resentfully at the teacher. So this is an ideal audience, and I'm very happy to be here. I thought I'd begin with a sort of interesting overview, which was news to me, from the London Review of Books, quite recently reviewing a new translation of the Iliad, but in looking around at a wider compass, I think, than we're used to considering. And so I note that, for example, the in China, the Lua Nianxing Wilson Wang translation of the Iliad is now available for 19 yuan, with a handsome portrait of Zeus on the cover. That Ahmed Etman's new prose translation of the Iliad into Arabic has been affordably priced at 250 Egyptian pounds, although the Egyptian Supreme Council of Cultures paperback is probably a cheaper version, and it's the translation by Suleiman al-Bustani in Arabic verse, made in 1904. And in Japan, Homer is so familiar that Japanese have been known to describe their own lengthy haiku epic as, quote, the Japanese Iliad. So I think that when we say that this is universal, we first of all try to see ways that it resonates with our own culture, but this is a testimony to something even bigger. My own direct experience with the universality of Homer, and indeed the classics in general, was an experience in 1982 to 1985. I established a small department of classics at University of Malawi in Southeast Africa. And I didn't know until I arrived that this had been a political appointment made directly by the dictator of Malawi, the longest ruling dictator in sub-Saharan Africa, Hastings Kamuzu Banza, the Ngwazi, or savior of his people, who was, amongst other things, an ardent classicist, and had, as I learned through living in Malawi, modeled Malawi on Plato's Republic, with himself as philosopher king. And so I found in this sort of extraordinary setup a wonderful testing ground for all these ideals that are spoken of very glibly and very facilely in our humanity survey courses, that these, you know, are universal and so on and so on. But in fact, they are. And the proof to me was in seeing how people, students and colleagues for a non-Western tradition, were able to embrace and indeed further my understanding of many of the works. And I stood shoulder to shoulder with colleagues, teaching colleagues who had grown up in authentic oral traditions and yet had gone on to get PhDs in Western universities abroad, and therefore stood in remarkable position to have insight into the true characteristics of oral traditions vis-a-vis more, I won't even say quite yet literary traditions, but individualized compositions. And I learned more from that experience than from all the monograms coming out from Harvard, for example, on how Homer's meant to work. So I'm fully convinced in the universality in the sort of broad cultural sense. And finally, to bring us sort of to the purpose of what I hope to do this evening, which is to answer very directly the question of why do we read Homer, I'd like to point to an incident that happened just a week or so ago when I was speaking to a group in Charleston, where I have been for this winter. Not that Maine winters aren't highly desirable, but there were many circumstances that made this a logical choice. And after I had spoken, a young gentleman came up and introduced himself as a naval lieutenant. And he said, you know, I can't believe, when I saw that this was your lecture, I couldn't believe it, because just last week, some other officers and I were debating about Achilles. And I thought this was absolutely fascinating. And I said, was this because of the sort of whole dilemma of leadership? And he said, well, yes, you know, is it the charge of the light brigade where you just go with your leader and follow the commands? Or, you know, where is your duty? And so I thought this is the touchstone of the potency of this epic, that when people whose business is in real terms, not literary terms or metaphorical terms, the business of war, that they could find something in this that would be a touchstone for clearly provoking a profound discussion on the issues of leadership. So this brings us to the central question, which is why are we studying this story? Is it because it's a very pretty tale and there are fairy tales that are also very ancient, although not as old as the Iliad? Are we beguiled by the gods and goddesses or the language? Probably not, because it seems to stay potent in a way that some of those other stories don't. So what? Why are we reading it? And that in turn provokes the question, what is the Iliad all about? And the first thing I'd like to do is say what it's not about and give some background into why you may think it's about what it's not about. It is not about the glorification of war. This epic was never intended to glorify war. Our inherited belief that it was intended to glorify war is a direct legacy of the British public school system. Until there were widely disseminated, easily acquired translations of the Iliad in English, I'm talking right now only about the English tradition, not even the German tradition or others, but just the tradition that we have in the English language, one really only knew the classics, and Homer is the Olympian of classics, if you were the proper sort of chap who'd gone to the right sort of educational institute. And in Britain, that meant Eton or Harrow or the other lesser public schools, and then on to Oxford or Cambridge. In America, it would have meant Groton, and then on into places like Harvard or Yale. But knowing Greek was very much the flip side of your school tie. It was there to show you'd had the right kind of education, which isn't to say it wasn't uncynically regarded as being something that one should know for all the right reasons as well. But if you think carefully about what those public school institutes were unashamedly, unabashedly invested in the 18th and 19th and 20th centuries, certainly, it was very much about teaching young, next generation of young manhood to die for king and country. And in the British schools, the sports culture always trumped the academic culture, and on the basis that sports were better training for young men who were going to die for king and country than, say, learning mathematics. So this was not a sort of peripheral or incidental element of the right of this kind of privileged school background. It was about creating the future officers and soldiers of an empire. And here you have the centerpiece of the classical tradition, the Everest, that the mighty work that cannot be avoided, which are the Homeric epics. And here, in the middle of this Homeric epic, the Iliad, the one that should be there to tell you how to die well for king and country, you have an inconvenient hero called Achilles, who in the first book of the opening lines of this martial epic challenges his commander-in-chief, as the young Navy lieutenant and his friends were clearly seeing, and said, "The Trojans didn't do anything to me. The Trojans never stole my cattle. They never attacked my soil. There's much that lies between us, the shadowy mountains and the echoing sea. We are here for your sake." And then, as if this isn't enough, the epic pulls back after Achilles withdraws from the war when the sort of terms of his engagement are broken by Agamemnon taking his prize, and shows a remarkable scene. And that scene, if you remember, shortly afterwards is where Agamemnon goes out to test his troops. He's had a dream of victory, and he goes out, and it's a false dream, as we, the reader, know, the audience know. And he said, but he goes out and he says to his men, "I'm going to test them first." And so he says, "Ah, you know, this war is no good. We're going to lose. You know, let's all go home. We've been here too long." And immediately there's a stampede of his whole army running for their ships. And it takes Odysseus running to the commander-in-chief, snatching the scepter of rule from Agamemnon's sort of helpless, shaking hands, and brandishing it himself and saying, he didn't mean it, go back, you don't understand what he's trying to say. This is a scene played out in great detail. So this is clearly meant to be about soldiers embroiled in a war that they do not understand or support anymore, and a charismatic spokesman who is Achilles, who dangerously has thrown down the gauntlet. This is not the kind of lesson, this is not the kind of hero you want little boys to have when you're trying to teach them about sort of stiff upper lip and going out to fight for king and country. At the same time, in the British public school curriculum, again, which we are direct inheritors of, you have the paragon hero, Aeneas. Everybody remember Aeneas? Aeneas, who sublimates his life, his love, his passions, his heart's desire for the great good of the empire. Aeneas, who leaves Dido in order to go and found Rome and sublimates all his own passions. Pious Aeneas. That's the kind of hero that you want as the role model. So a lot of the spin that was put on the Iliad, this is where the term Achilles sulking in his tent comes from. These are very deliberate attempts to neutralize the most glamorous figure in the whole of epic tradition and say, but he's just a thug, you know, and he's sulking. He's not a fair player, you know, he's a bounder. And we must turn our emotional support to Hector, who's dying fighting for his country. So the first thing I'm going to say is, whatever the Iliad is about, put what you might have thought it was about out of your head. It is not about glorifying war. So what is it, in fact, about? Well, some of the things that are sharpening to our point of view or help us see what the epic has chosen to pay attention to are by looking at the things the epic chose to discard. And the Iliad was not the only epic floating around at its time. There is a sort of amorphous, sprawling mass of epic stories that we are never going to, at this distance in time, quite clarify what strain came from where and how they were fashioned and how handed down. But we do know that there were a web of epic stories that covered the entirety of the Trojan War from absolute origin to absolute end and post-end. So we have an epic that told about the mustering of the troops to go to Troy, about the first false landing at Troy where Agamemnon led his men and landed on the wrong beach, and then they all went back again, and then he came again. Something about Agamemnon that the epic tradition was clearly sort of trying to point up. And then we have, you know, the unfolding of the war, the abduction or seduction of Helen, and then we have the fall of Troy, the death of Achilles, the fall of Troy, the plundering of Troy, and then the scattering of all of the heroes. None of this is in our Iliad, but it was all out there. And we know it was out there not just because later traditions pick this up. Many of the Greek tragedies pick sort of epic themes and expand on certain characters in sort of post-Iliadic situations. But we know because while the epics themselves did not survive, and one theory why they didn't survive is they simply weren't as, once the Iliad happened, the others sort of, all the competition fell away. But be that for whatever reason, the other epics did not survive, but we have outlines of them. And most of these come from a single work by somebody writing, a Greek philosopher named Proclus, who's writing in the 5th century AD and has a little pressy description of each of the lost works. So the Cypria, the Kypria, which is about the origins of the war, and he has sort of an outline, and then there are a few things that we think might have been lines from it. And so in this way, we know what the body of literature was all about. So the first piece of evidence is that the Iliad is not interested in some of the conventional dramatic events that one would normally associate with a great dramatic telling about a war, specifically how it began and how it ended. We know in the Iliad, we know it has begun because of Helen, but we're not really, even she has been sort of blurred a little bit. She's one of the most finely drawn, most human characters in the epic. But she's most human because she's She curses her. She blames herself for having been seduced by Paris. So in other words, she was not abducted. And most of the sort of origins of Trojan War stories are predicated on the belief that she was stolen or kidnapped or raped or taken away. So here we have the woman who sort of willingly left her husband, now regrets it, but hardly cause for war in the traditional sense. So these omissions, these things the Iliad has chosen to sort of say, all right, I know about them because I know about the origin of the war. Here's Helen in my epic, but I'm not going to go into all the detail of how she was stolen and how she was abducted, which would obviously be a great story. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in approximately 2 weeks of the most, in a way, inconsequential period of this 10-year war in the final year of the war. And it's inconsequential because it's the period where the siege is not happening. There's enemy action, but no walls are breached on the Trojan side. So it focuses attention immediately on sort of on events, if you will, closer to home, rather than the grand traditional epic events. So it's always worth looking at what's not in the works as well as what is in the works, if you have evidence that what is not in the works could have been in the works. So let's look at some of the things that are not in the Iliad. One is, as I've said, a sort of true dramatic unfolding of the origin of the war. And then possibly as important, an exploration of the meaning of the war. It is deeply disconcerting to find that the Greeks, this is a Greek epic about a Greek undertaking for a Greek cause to bring back Helen, it is deeply disconcerting to be made so inescapably aware that no one wants to be there. This scene set early on in the epic, which I described, where everybody's trying to flee to their ships, is extraordinary, because it means that you've heard the soldier citizens speak, and they just want to go home. And this is then picked up and amplified in the following books. If you remember the first duel scene between Paris, who is the sort of new Helen's new man, and Menelaus, her abandoned husband. And this occurs early again in the books 3 and 4 of the Iliad, and now we're going to have, you know, the war settled for all time. These two men will fight it out personally. The terms are set. Sacred oath is sworn. Whoever wins takes home Helen and all her possessions, and the others live in friendship. And then Homer turns his attention to the soldiers seated around watching this duel about to unfold, and they pray to God. And they say, "Dear Zeus, whoever started this thing, let that person suffer and let all the rest of us go home and in sworn oaths of friendship." This is, again, very disarming, because the epic is continually blunting its own cause for having the soldiers there. So there isn't in the epic is high moral purpose or high moral conviction for fighting, certainly from the Greek point of view. The other thing that isn't in there is a clear sense of the enemy. While the players themselves, Greeks and Trojans, have marked hostility towards each other, we're now concerned with what the audience, what we, the reader, are meant to be feeling. And this blurring of enemy lines is made apparent in both details and in grand design. Some of the details: there are approximately 250 warriors who are killed in the Iliad. There are three times as many Trojans killed as Greeks. Most of these deaths, as you will have known and observed, are accompanied by some little description of who that fallen soldier was. His parents, how he was conceived, that he was a shepherd, that his parents was a priest and had, but could not predict his death. Just some small humanizing detail. Most of these characters come to life only to be killed, if you will. But the cumulative effect of this is part of the humanity of the Iliad, always in displacing the moment of glory to, even if just in passing, even in a sort of ephemeral emotion of regret for the life that was lost. But three times as many Trojans are killed as Greeks. That means that you, the audience, are made to contemplate three times the number of regrettable losses on behalf of the Trojans and the Greeks. This is an extraordinary feature of a martial epic written in Greek for a Greek audience. The other obvious way in which the enemy lines are most blurred is, of course, the famous scene with the departure of Andromache and Hector. Again, fairly early in the epic, book six. After book six, if it's possible to really wish for Hector to be killed, one should just be sort of dismissed into outer darkness. I defy anybody to read that book and wish for Hector to be slain and Andromache widowed. They are the enemy. This is a Greek epic, and it's written in Greek, and the Greeks are going to win this war. Why would you do this unless you were determined to insist on the humanity of the other side? I believe there's some way we could possibly track this historically. What we know about the origins of the epic, as you will probably have surmised from the readings you've been given, is it began as a very old tradition that was passed down orally. Its origins are somewhere in the Bronze Age, possibly even earlier, according to some theories. After the Mycenaean world falls, which is that Greek age of golden Mycenae that the Iliad is nostalgically recreating, the Mycenaean civilization falls for reasons still not understood around 1200 BC and set in motion a whole series of migrations, as you can imagine, with a sort of displaced peoples just going to look for better lives. Those in Thessaly, we know for dialectical reasons, slowly migrate east and settle on the island of Lesbos, which is very close to the Turkish shore, hours away today by boat, and then slowly drift over to the Asia Minor mainland. If you look on the maps that you've been given, you'll see that on the second page of the sort of little segment of maps, the second page shows the island of Lesbos and shows Phthia and Iolcus, which are the towns in Thessaly. Achilles, of course, is from Thessaly. He's a Thessalian hero, and he repeatedly invokes his home country in a way that none of the other characters evoke their homelands in Greece. So we believe that this was the tradition from northern Greece in Thessaly that wended its way and settled on the island of Lesbos and was in place, settled down, more or less colonized by about 1000 BC, possibly earlier. That area that had been settled, archaeologists know had for 3,000 or so years been Trojan in culture. By Trojan, I don't mean that they on the island of Lesbos understood their identity as Trojan. I mean that the culture of the Trojans, of the people living in historical Troy, which will be the subject of one of your discussions, their culture was in Troy and spilled out into the surrounding area. So you have an extraordinary situation, which you have refugees from the fallen Greek civilization of Mycenae who've wended their way east and are now in the shadow of the other fallen civilization, which tradition and probably history has it that they destroyed. And they're now settled in amongst these people where the story is percolated and incubated. I believe that this accounts in great part for this blurring of enemy lines, is that at this stage, by the time the Iliad is really taking on its themes, it has come to understand that there is a shared history, shared tragedy, and shared humanity. Another thing that's missing in this great martial epic is any praise of war. And for this evidence, I'm going to read from one of the most dry, solid, unfrivolous, stern voices of academia, which is that of Walter Leaf writing his great commentary in 1895. This Walter Leaf's commentary on the Iliad is the grandfather of all commentaries on the Iliad. So any other commentary you get, and by this I mean the linguistic minutiae, people will say sort of either as Leaf says or contrary to Leaf, you know, with a little bit of nervousness, but you don't ignore Walter Leaf. But the important thing is this epic, this what I'm going to read, has not been published by a professor in postmodern age from University of Berkeley or from Columbia University. This is not revisionism. He notes on a curious word that appears in the Iliad, the charmes, which appears in the phrase where in book four of the Iliad, Menelaus has been wounded and Agamemnon says to him, you know, oh, my brother, I hope you're okay. And then while Menelaus is being sort of patched up, the poet, the Iliad says, and then the men put on their armor and remembered their charmes of war. Okay, charmes, Walter Leaf says, usually referred to from the root car as meaning battle joy. And this is supported by, and then he gives another textual reference. But Homer never represents his heroes as taking any delight in battle, except by the direct interposition of a god, as in the above passage. On the contrary, he lavishes all epithets of hatred upon war. Lugris, that which produces groans. Polydacrus, that of many tears. Dusalagus, of hard pains. Dus ecus, inos, terrible, baneful, etc. And then he goes on to postulate that the primitive meaning of the word car is gar, and has more to do with the fire or burning flame, and therefore it means sort of the spirit within one. But the point of all of this is that so striking is it that there that this, on one occasion, in these 15,000 plus lines, that there's one word that could potentially suggest that any soldier took any joy in warfare is so shocking that this dry, fusty scholar has to object. And not just object, but clarify. And so this is sort of very bracing stuff. So let's just take a sort of survey here. We have a war epic that challenges, in the first book, the correctness of the war and the right of the commander-in-chief to rule, that goes out of its way to show that the enemy is no enemy, that shows no moral conviction for the war and no interest in the victory, because it just cuts before that part even comes up. The Iliad ends, as you know, with the death of Hector, not with the fall of Troy, or even though the fall of Troy is imminent, is implicit in the Iliad, it is not interested in giving you a scene of victorious Greeks coming in and looting the city. So one thing that is remarkable to me is that in all the years that I studied the Iliad as a student, I never ever had any professor or any class ever describe or discuss war. This is an epic about war, but we never discussed war. We discussed weaponry. We discussed how there was a hint of an anachronism because the lines of battle as described by Nestor were more like those that would probably come in classical Greece and therefore showed a corruption of the text and the hoplite tactics infiltrating rarefied concerns such as that. We talked in general terms about the tragic vision of Homer, about shared humanity, about how Achilles recovers his humanity. But war was always treated as if it was some sort of metaphor that just allowed all these great characters to come out and expound their humanity for us. But I believe that this epic represents the distilled wisdom of real life experience. And I've hinted at some of that in that sort of Thessalian migration to the East on the one hand. But I think that the reason we read the Iliad today is because it represents the most complete evocation of the experience of war that is yet available. Because it is set in the mythic past, it is immune from political concerns. We don't care about who started it or why. And this is impossible with wars that are still going on in our own time. You can't talk dispassionately of the war in Iraq. You have to talk about should we have gone or shouldn't we? And we get bogged down, if you will, in other issues, critical issues, crucial issues, but different issues. The mythic past inoculates the Iliad from that kind of specificity on the one hand. It's even-handedness. No other war treatment I know, even sort of All Quiet on the Western Front, is so even-handed, emotionally even-handed, in ensuring the emotional response of the audience alights equally on the so-called heroes as well as on the so-called enemies. But most especially, it evokes the totality of war. And not only the great and glorious heroes like Hector and Achilles, but the small heroes who exist only to die. It shows victor and it shows vanquished. It shows the great hero, it shows the small hero. And it shows the civilian and it shows the widow and the soon-to-be widowed. And it shows the father and the soon-to-be bereft father. And it shows the destroyed mother, the mother of Hector, and it shows the mother of Achilles, who's tormented throughout the whole epic by the fact her son will soon die. It shows orphan and widow, an old person and young person, and male and female. And in that way, it shows the total universe of war. And so that is why I think we study the Iliad today. The fact that it is as ancient as it is all the more sobering. Because if it is still relevant today, I don't think Homer intended this to still be relevant today. I can't imagine that people thought that the same state of affairs would go on forever and forever and forever with sort of no clear end in sight. But I feel, to me, the Iliad is a message in the bottle, which was the distilled wisdom of real war experience that had been forged through great and ancient myths that we still will never quite tease out and sort of put onto the seas of time and still wash up. And whenever you open the bottle and read it, there is something that hits the heart. And clearly it's not just in our own culture, but as suggested by these other translations across the world. I've been asked to make a few comments on the new task, epic task of translating the Iliad, and I've mercifully run down the clock so much that I will have very little time to say anything. But I thought I would give a few sort of tidbits, if you will. The grand schemes, I think, the grand tasks of translating, I think, are very well covered in that New Yorker review that's in your package. So I thought I would just pick on a few very picky little details that show how the small things, in a way, are as nagging and as difficult sometimes as the great and beautiful words. The first is that, and this allows me to vent against the latest translation, which is that of Stephen Mitchell's as well. You may have heard that one of his decisions was to do away with all Homeric epithets. So swift-footed Achilles only means Achilles. Hero, white-armed hero only means white-armed. Hector, the shining helm, only means Hector. So what I've have here is a very inconsequential passage, because I think those are fairer tests than the sort of great and fiery ones. And this is Agamemnon getting up after that false dream of his, where he's going to have to go out and tell his men, you know, that he thinks Troy can be taken on this day. So he rises from sleep, and the Iliad has up to this point been quite pointed against Agamemnon. And so we get the sense that he is in, he's commander-in-chief of the Greeks because he rules the most powerful kingdom, that he's inherited this from his father. Nothing has been said of him that inspires any confidence that he would have this position were he not the king of Mycenae. And so there's a certain, not effeteness about him, but pamperedness about him, indulged is perhaps a better word. So this is what the fairly nuts and bolts translation of this passage reads. He woke from sleep, and the divine voice of Zeus, of the dream, was poured around him. Agamemnon sat upright and donned his soft tunic, fresh and fine, and cast his great cloak round him, and bound beneath his smooth feet his splendid sandals. And then he cast about his shoulders his silver-studded sword, took up the scepter of his father's imperishable eternal, and with this set forth towards the ships of the armor-clad Achaeans. Here's what's happened when you take all those pesky adjectives out. Then he woke with the dream's voice swirling around him. Agamemnon sat up, got out of bed, put on a tunic, threw his great cloak round him, fastened his sandals onto his feet, and slung his silver-bossed sword over his shoulders, took his ancestral staff, and stepped out to walk alongside the Achaean ships. So the belief that all those epithets, such as smooth feet or fine cloak, are just there for decoration is not sound. I mean, they're there to layer portraits. So if I can steer you towards translations such as Latimer or Fagel's, I would like to do so. And finally, a very small point, but to me quite telling, is one line that's sort of fascinating. It's where Nestor is saying to Agamemnon, don't insult Achilles. He is our greatest strength, our bulwark, our defense against war, excuse me, Kakos war, or Kakoyos war in as it's declined. Kakos is a very basic word. It's one of the first words you learn in any Greek. It means bad. Specifically, craven, worthless, baneful, malevolent, bringing evil, ill, baneful, disastrous, harmful. Polemos kakos, bad war, evil war. It's pretty unambiguous. Fascinatingly, Latimer omits the word altogether. Just says it'd be a bulwark against war. That's a small point, but it's part of this point of that I believe that the Iliad itself is persisting in trying to evoke war as something that is devastating. Fitzgerald, one of the great poetic translations, says the black waves of war. That's very nice imagery, but it doesn't quite condemn war as inexorably as evil war does. And Fagel says, our rugged bulwark backed for shocks of war, which is potent, but again, I think the cleaner word here is just evil war. And so that's the kind of decisions that somebody has to make when one approaches this. Are you going to rise for poetic effect? Are you going to try and cleave as close as possible to the Greek? Thank you very much.
This podcast was brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council, with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities and Friends Like You. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.